You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. Sierra Leone is a country with a rich and complex history. It made its name as a place of refuge amid bondage. Over 200 years ago, the country became an anomaly in the heart of the West African slave coast, serving as a haven for freed slaves of the British Empire who fled the Americas and crossed the Atlantic again, this time on their own terms, to return to Africa. In the early 1960s, the former British colony gained its independence during a wave of decolonization and newly found freedom for Africa. And for the last 60 years, it's endured threats of military takeover, autocracy, and brutal civil war. Now in peacetime, Sierra Leone's democratic state is grappling with its complicated past, working to rebuild after violence, and looking to find hope for its future. And today, in 2022, the country is still defining its identity. Over the next hour, we're going to feature two people with families and strong roots in Sierra Leone, and whose own identities and work are deeply tied to their home country, its past, its trauma, and its promise. Chernor Ba was born and raised in Sierra Leone and came of age during the country's decade-long civil war. Today, Chernor runs Purposeful, an Africa-rooted organization that places girls and young women at the center of development in the Global South and seeks to reinvent the humanitarian aid system that he first encountered as a boy 30 years ago. Chernor Ba, welcome to World Affairs. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
Well, here in the U.S., we got news of the civil wars in West Africa. Of course, it sounded terrible, granted, but sometimes the headlines just don't penetrate. They don't give you the full picture. It's just more bad news from a faraway place that almost all Americans have never been to. What happened to daily life during Sierra Leone's civil war? What was your life like as a boy?
I've always talked about it as it was basically stolen childhood. And now I'm a father. I look at the life I want my kids to have. Mine was snatched by me by just the sound of gunshots and the fear of making the next day, the fear of having food, the indignity of being displaced and being a refugee, questioning your humanity and your existence. So when you are living in the middle of war, your experience is of just fear, horror, and terror. You know, the things I saw as a child are things that no human being should see. You know, I walked on cops. I had to be afraid for my life. I found myself in between and among rebels, running, hiding with my mom and my two sisters sometimes. And then, as I said, the indignity of being a refugee on a displaced, where you have to line up for food, where you're questioned, even by the host country, where you become a number and not a person because your family now becomes, you know, yeah, this number, you have to come and this is time for you to get this thing and that thing. So that's what I remember of the experience. I have to say, it's a lot of that experience is one that you try to bury as well, especially as you try to look up and have a positive outlook on life. You leave that behind you because it has so much trauma and so many terrible memories.
I want to talk about exactly that later, but should we assume that as bad as it was potentially even more dangerous, even more disorienting for children? Was it worse for you than it was for your parents?
I think now that I'm a parent, I'll be a little careful to say that because I think the parent also has the additional fear of what will happen to your child. But for a child, yes, when I think about, God forbid, my kids will have to experience that. As I said, it steals your childhood from you. It takes away the comfort of the expectation of wonder of this world, right? You grew up as a child, you're blessed with love and affection and peace and tranquility. That's what our childhood was before the war, right? That's what it was defined by. It was defined by moonlight and sunshine and playing on the beach and in the water. And all of that is just interrupted. So yes, it's particularly bad for kids because it's shocking and it takes away your childhood, your humanity at a very early age. But I must say it was even worse for girls. because while as a boy, I was very worried, and I've talked often about how there were moments where I thought the best thing to do would be to enlist, because Sierra Leone's war was also defined by its cruel use of children as soldiers who perpetrated themselves or were made to perpetrate some heinous crimes. But there was a time when you will think, as well as a child growing up, that this is probably the right thing to do, because if you want to stay alive, protect your family. So young people were making that choice. And I knew that I came close to making those choices. But for girls, it was worse, because you could be sex slaves. You could be sexually violated by not just the rebels, but also by aid workers, but also by other people in your community, because the war forced us as well to now live in shacks, in slums, in refugee and displaced settings where we're all together. And girls, definitely the risk are then heightened. And then the duty of providing for family, which is another thing, increases for girls in conflict and in emergencies. And we've seen this as well continuing in other emergencies. But I grew up with two sisters, and I think the work I do today is definitely informed by the experience I had in the war as a displaced person, as a refugee, growing up and being raised by a single mom, and watching my two sisters and the outcomes and the things that they had to grapple with.
Did you have to become old, young? When you were getting involved in humanitarian aid, you were only 15 years old. At a time when, you know, you might be practicing football after school, or maybe getting a job to earn a couple of extra paychecks to help your family along, but you're working in humanitarian aid. Did it make you grow up fast, this whole experience, and also give you an education earlier than most people might expect about how this whole humanitarian aid system works?
Ray, I did not have time to be a child. I couldn't be a child. The war stole that away from me, the luxury of thinking of myself as a child, because even then, living and working with my parents and my siblings, I just felt this burden on me, and just seeing the war and the agony and the injustice. I had to grow up. I had to be aware. I had to protect myself. I had to think about sexual violence of my siblings. I had to organize. I just thought, as children, we suffered so much in the war. We had to be part of the peace. We had to contribute to it. And for me, it started off, as you're saying about, it gave me an opportunity to have a different form of education. It made me aware of what was happening around me pretty fast. And frankly, it started off by me just admiring aid workers and admiring all these people who were driving in SUVs and coming to save our lives. And I wanted to be like them. And I wanted to say, oh, I wanted to do human rights work, because that was nice. That was something that if you're doing human rights work, you could end up working for an NGO. Then you could also be the people who have the SUVs and you're driving around. So it exposed me to a completely different world while still in the joy and the peace of, and you're right, the enjoyment of playing soccer on a beach. It stole that away from me very early on.
So here we are. You see this world. You get to look over the fence into this world of people driving around in swell new Toyota pickup trucks and SUVs and wearing shirts, custom-made shirts with the logo of their agency on the pocket, and all the little signs of somebody who's connected to a big multinational aid organization, and you want to be part of that world. How did you become a critic of that world at the same time?
So I think of a very specific moment where we're on a field trip. And, you know, I run a national organization now, and I'm working with some donors, and we're all showing up in this community. And we are on an unannounced field trip, which is very classic in this kind of setting, because, you know, we have to go check if everything is being done right. But most of us who show up are super well-educated. Almost all of the others are white in our SUVs and show up in this poor community, in this poor village. And we're checking in on this local organization that is rooted in their community and that are there, working there. But we go there and we start asking for the benches and the chairs and whether everything there has been put to use and things like that. And I just know, just from my own background and my own instinct, that I had a deja vu moment. I'd been through these kinds of things so many times, where you're asking those questions and you see the condescension and the patronization of that in that relationship and everything else that is inherent in those set of questions, in the reality of how you show up and the relationship between you and the people in that community, the words you use to describe them, they are beneficiaries of aid. And therefore, we have to make sure that they're going to be accountable to us. All of those words. And for me, an experience like that, as I said, it brought me back to all the experiences I've had in my life, where both, as I said, being in a refugee camp or being in New York, where I was working for the UN in green rooms and speaking at the General Assembly and all that. And I'm thinking, there's something not right about this equation. A, the idea that we're just parachuting into this community. And I'm here. I'm a witness. I'm part of it. I'm participating in this ritual that it's not about developing that community. Questions the humanity of the people in that community. Treats them like these people who are coming are more invested in their communities and know much more about what they want to do and how change shall happen in their community. And are setting all the stringent measures in language that the people in that community do not understand. And it's not really relevant for their development. And yet, that's the norm. That's when it struck me that something is fundamentally amiss here. And the more I questioned and read and tried to understand all the experiences I'd had in about 20 years in this industry, I came to understand that there's a lot of this is rooted in a colonial understanding and relationship of what the global north has, knowledge, power, resources, versus those in the global south who are recipients of it. The idea that who to trust, black and brown bodies are not trustworthy, and therefore we need to go check up on them. We need to put all these measures in place. We need to instruct them. We need to teach them about development, even in their own communities. For me, that's when I decided that this is something we need to talk about. We need to name it, and we need to work towards reforming it. That the people who are doing it, I like to point out, are not necessarily bad people, but we're all complicit in a system that is supposed to be designed for development, but is based on such harmful assumptions and practices that is actually counterproductive to development.
I understand completely what you're talking about when you talk about the patronization and the condescension, and the suspicion, frankly, that comes along with it. But some of that is being pressed onto the very workers in the field who are checking on this accountability by the people who are supplying the money, whether it's politicians in the capital city in a Western country or donors and philanthropists who want to be sure that their money is being spent effectively, being spent properly, not being lost to corruption and feather bedding, and making the people who are the first recipients of their money rich instead of filtering down to the people who need the aid the most. Is there a way of having this system operate around trust instead of suspicion if you have the natural impulse to desire to know that the money you're giving is being spent properly? I think that's a natural desire, whether you're a politician or a philanthropic donor. And at the same time, it might be less harmful if it was done out of trust rather than suspicion. I'm not sure if there's any way to rebuild that relationship. How would you do it?
Thank you so much. I'm really happy you're asking that, because I think that the foundation of our work, our Purposeful, is a trust-based relationship. That's exactly what we're trying to do. And I think in general, I want to maybe question a couple of things. One is this resource that is being transferred from especially certain governments and certain nations to the global south, this is not from the goodness of their hearts. This is not some kind of altruistic giving away to poor people. Some of it has to be noted is rooted in extractive and exploitative relationships that have happened between us. And that's not acknowledging, by the way, in the global aid discourse that, you know, our societies were plundered, they were stolen from us many times, and that their own security is also rooted in our own security. Our own welfare is rooted. So if it's based on a principle of solidarity. The second thing is the assumption that corruption is only inherent in the sector that is dominated by brown and black people. So by the way, there's a coincidence in where all these accountability measures are put in place, because it assumes that, oh, we can't trust those people. And those people typically are black and brown people. And that's how, it's just how the development sector is constructed, and nobody really questions that. And I think that's problematic, that needs to be questioned. But the reality of it, Ray, is that in actual fact, many of the times when money is given to communities that's based on trust, and we do that, and again, in small ways, we have funds that give unrestricted resources to communities and to that trust them, that sees them as human beings, that says, you know, actually, we drove here in SUVs and you can use that money as well to pay for your community and to send your own kids to school as well, because that's what a trust-based relationship will be. We see that people use those resources as well to transform their communities, except they do it not in the ways that we want. Because we want to do it in ways that follow a very strict procedure and set of guidelines that we have, that we have imported. And I often tell this story of, if I flew from Sierra Leone and went to San Francisco and said, oh, there are problems in San Francisco and we need to solve those problems, and I have some money, and because I have some money, and it's coming, by the way, from the goodness of my heart, but you need to spend this money in ways only that I dictate and report to me only in a language that, by the way, I speak in Sierra Leone, and do all of these things in a very specific way, it would be laughable. It would be ridiculous. But we don't question that, because we assume that the Western model of development is what development is. People can embark on their own path to development. And yes, you can have trust and solidarity and give resources to people to explore and experiment and work with. If it's based on trust, actually, you can have a lot of positive outcomes.
So how should it look different? If there are international NGOs, if there are international organizations made up of representative governments that recognize there's need in Sierra Leone, recognize there's a reason to be there and help the country recover from a terrible civil war, how should it look different? What should it look like?
Brilliant. I think there are some examples, actually, that sometimes we ignore. The Marshall Plan in the UK to Europe was not aid as we see today. It was actually a development initiative. The US still gives a lot of money to many countries in the world that is not classed as traditional aid. We just saw the US Congress gave a lot of money to Ukraine, and we support that. We love that. But again, it's not limited by all these strings and pass-throughs and middle organizations that go through. It's trusting those people as allies, as human beings with agency who can chart their own path. It's working with them to define their own development path and allow them to embark on that path. In terms of the international aid industry, we're beginning to see a difference, actually. Purposeful is working with a lot of progressive donors now. We're saying no to a lot of money from the major bilateral donors who come with this unreasonable restrictions, who say you basically have to create an entire sector specifically to just respond to the accountability needs of the donor. We found, and we've received money from major international donors, we found that just servicing those donors take way more time than actually doing the real work. So the fear somehow is you spend way more money on it, the so-called due diligence procedures and all that. And by the way, the people that know that very well, that have mastered the art of that, that we have to hire to do that work, are agencies that are based in their capitals, in London and in DC. They have a whole industry there that have mastered the art. So what we advocate is trust-based relationships, unrestricted resources to organizations. We've seen Mackenzie Scott, who is giving out billions, actually, to institutions that are already doing good work, and say, we trust you because you're already doing this work, to go about and do more of it. And you're not hearing scandals of CEOs like us taking those money and now flying in private jet. That's not what's happening, because you're giving the money to organizations that are actually invested in their communities. They are activists. They're people who love their communities, who want to do this work. And I think we need to begin to see the shift in that. Let me put it this way as well. If we were to say to develop my community where my parents came from in a small island in Banff, how will you do that if you had the resources? You will go there, you'll meet with the people, You'll have them have a conversation about what they think are their priorities and give them that money in an ideal world to go about and implement and support them only as they ask and how you do it, if it's based on mutual respect and solidarity. Or the current model, which is you will tell them that the money has to be spent on this thing and reported to you back in a different language and these kinds of way. So I think there's a way, and I think that more and more donors are coming to see that different way, that a relationship based on mutual trust, respect, and solidarity is more productive. It recognizes our collective humanity and moves us all in the right direction.
Along with cultivating that model of a different approach toward the way money is appropriated and spent, you're also trying to rebuild the context. You've noted that when the international aid industry refers to youth, they mean men. They mean men, young men, disproportionately. Do you think, as you look at how the world community responded, that the design, that the consciousness about what needs to be done, where and when, designs those responses to women and girls into the program? When aid is rushed into a conflict zone, are they conscious of the fact that young women and girls have different needs from other refugees?
Sadly not. I think we've seen with too many crisis. In fact, Purposeful, the organization I lead, was founded as a response to the Ebola crisis. And I was here not working as an aid worker, but, you know, I left New York where I was to visit and see what was happening and traveling around the country, and just was shocked at the fact that the aid industry was responding at a time to the crisis, basically told girls and women and people who are doing social work and responding to the needs of girls to go home because it was too dangerous to be out. The needs, the special needs of adolescent girls was considered an afterthought. In fact, those of us who talked about it were being made to seem unreasonable, because how dare you think about gender and girls when people are dying? Again, it's the dehumanization of people who are in the middle of crisis and humanitarian settings. So what you see often in the response is the belittling, the pushing back as if this doesn't matter right now, or if it matters, it only matters when things are now settled. And what you end up having is, by the time you are back to a sense of normalcy, things have become much worse for girls. We saw that during the Ebola crisis here. We saw that during the civil war in this country. And we continue to see that as well during this current corona epidemic.
How do you, at the same time as you're trying to do this really big lift of getting people to rethink the way they give money and the way they track where it goes, also have them rethink how these programs are designed and what they're meant to accomplish by no longer neglecting or leaving girls out of their ideas about what development is?
Yeah, small task, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
No, I think one of the, yeah, what we've seen, and I think many, many studies have shown that now, that hard to reach is hard to reach because people don't want to, A, do the work that's spend the time that's required to understand and make the so-called risk. So it's the same thing around who should have access to money. We talk at Purposeful about giving money directly to girls. We say you have to think about girls, and money is power, and you have to give girls money. And every time we say that, people's antennas go up because they have so many assumptions about particularly poor adolescent girls in poor countries. The idea that you can give them money is on its face so risky to so many people. So we resort back and say, A, girls are worth the risk because money is actually what everybody needs. And B, when you don't give them money, many, many studies in our work, we've seen this so many times, that girls need to survive. And girls are living in a constant crisis. We can talk about that. Child marriage, FGM, teenage pregnancy. This is the reality of particularly poor girls. And they are navigating their communities. They are navigating survival. They want food, transport to go to school, taking care of their babies, taking care of their families. What are they doing? How are they trying to get money? Because they have oftentimes the least agency in their communities, the least capacity to make money in their communities. All they have are their buddies. So everybody is so afraid to give the people who need money the most money because it's so risky. It's a very weird set of explanations, and we're pushing back on that and saying that's the foundation of all of this. It's supporting girls to be visible. It's saying that girls can have and do have agency, supporting them to organize among themselves, making sure that they have access to resources, because we all do need resources. We all do need money, and money in the hands of the right people can be liberating.
Now, I'm glad that the audience gets to hear this from your particular mouth, in your particular voice, with your particular accent, because I've been covering development and policy built around development for decades. And one of the occasional pushbacks you'll hear on a girl-centered approach is, oh, well, you can't fly in from Oslo or Paris or London or Washington and bring your modern notions of feminism and the rights and place in society of women. That's putting a Western matrix on traditional life as it's lived in much of the rest of the world. You have to respect local tradition. You have to respect local practices. So that money should go through a village headman, for instance, who is, like the name implies, always a headman. And you know, that money should be overseen by patriarchs of family units who have traditionally been the source of authority, traditionally been the source of permission, traditionally been the source of that kind of financial support. So if you go in with this feminist idea, you're going to upset all these traditional notions of how these towns and villages, farming communities are supposed to run. So like I say, I'm glad they're hearing Shenor Ba saying it instead of me, because this is an African saying it instead of some Western guy in a world capital saying that this is the way the money is ought to be spent. I'm sure that you get some pushback of your own, especially in a largely Muslim society, when you want to elevate the status of women.
Absolutely. We get that all the time. And I start by affirming my identity. I'm a proud African Fulani Muslim man. I'm very, very proud of my identity. And I'm also a very proud feminist. I also understand that the notion that feminism is an imported idea is actually insulting to my people and my ancestors. I happen to know some of my history, and I know that girls and women have been organizing for a very long time in my society and in different forms of African society. And everybody has always wanted that same desire that you Americans talk about, which is the desire for freedom and equality and justice and access to resources and access to wealth is a fundamental part of that. When people push back and call us foreign inspired or, you know, trying to change our society, we said yes. We own that. We're trying to change society. We reject the world as is because it's an unequal world. It's an unequal world, not just in our parts of the world, in Africa, but in all parts of the world. We want a more just, a more equitable society where all girls can live in their full power. And but if all girls live in their full power, all men, we believe, and everybody can live in their full power. The way I talk about this, for example, to my family, because sometimes I get asked and push back around my family, is my interest in this is not just altruistic. I'm not doing this because I love my mom and, oh my God, I might have a daughter. It's like people like to reduce this argument to, oh, it's an emotional argument. You've got to care about women and girls. I said, no, I grew up poor. Look, I was born in the slums of Freetown and raised by a single mom and two sisters. It is but only for the grace of God that I am where I am. So I know what poverty is. I saw injustice living through the war and seeing all kinds of abuse happen to women and girls around me. But I've learned that at the heart of those two things is discrimination against females, particularly against girls. And the way you change that, and I think many smarter people than me have said this, if there's any magic bullet that can actually hit at the heart of poverty and hit at the heart of injustice, it's an investment in girls. If your girls, I say to members of my community, if all the girls in this community are educated and are empowered, we will forget about poverty, because they will lead us into the future. So I do this not just because I want to, oh, I care about, you know, the women and girls, but I also care about myself. I don't want to be the future of this country to be poor. And that's exactly why I do this work.
Shenor Ba is the co-founder and co-head of an organization based in Sierra Leone called Purposeful. It's an Africa-rooted hub for girls activism. Shenor, it was a great pleasure to speak to you. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there other international stories you'd like us to be covering? Send an email or voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Ryan Housel, Elise Manoukian, and Andrew Stelzer. Research and fact-checking was provided by Ryan Housel and Elise Manoukian. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimp. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.